Welcome to Focus on Business Radio, a program dedicated to maximizing your business success through interviews with subject matter experts, information on critical aspects of starting and doing business, and providing insights through shared success stories. While no two businesses are exactly alike, successful businesses share common characteristics. Those characteristics are what we explore in each program. I'm Lee Strickland, your host from FocusResourcesInc.com. I am an entrepreneur, small business owner for over 15 years, an author, columnist, and a subject matter expert on business processes and growth, including the financial and operational aspects of doing business. I built my business from scratch in 2002 with no business contacts in this area to a nationally recognized resource for business startups, government contractors and grant recipients, and with the media. I have clients in 46 states, Canada, and Mexico, and each day I bring to my clients, listeners, and readers practical information on how to build a profitable, thriving business, whether it is a traditional brick-and-mortar mom and pop or an innovative startup spinning out of a university. Now, the comments, views, and opinions on this program are educational and do not reflect the views of WCOM, its board, and underwriters. And the information is shared. Information shared is not meant to replace specific advisory services for your business. Always consult with qualified, experienced, and reputable business and legal advisors before making any decision impacting your business. Today's topic is intellectual property, and my guest is returning guest, subject matter expert Lyle Gravitt. Attorney Lyle Gravitt joined the Forest Firm's Raleigh office in January of this year and leads the firm's intellectual property practice. His new role at the Forest Firm focuses on patents, trademarks, and intellectual property licensing and agreements. His strategic perspectives and experience in a wide range of technologies allows clients to protect and monetize their intellectual property assets in coordination with their business goals. Lyle provides end-to-end services from competitive intelligence and portfolio reviews to filing and prosecuting applications for building value. Lyle joined the Forest Firm after more than 3 years practicing intellectual property law in the Raleigh office of the NK Patent Law. Full disclosure, NK Patent Law and Lyle have been IP attorneys for my firms, and he prepared and prosecuted patents and trademarks with the United States Patent and Trademark Office, as well as international regulatory entities. Lyle holds a bachelor's degree in physics from Wake Forest University, where he performed biophysics research. He attended the University of Mississippi School of Law, earning his JD degree in 2010. He is a practicing lawyer here in the state of North Carolina and a member of the North Carolina Bar Association. You can reach Lyle at lyle.gravitt@forestfirm.com through the forestfirm.com website, and you can follow him on Twitter at Lyle Gravitt. Lyle, thanks for being on the show today.
Hey, thanks, Lee. Great to see you again, and great to be here again.
Well, we're going to talk all things intellectual property. And so what does that cover?
Intellectual property generally covers four areas. There's the three most people know about, and that's copyrights, trademarks, and patents. And then there's also a fourth more gray area called trade secrets, which is kind of a catch-all for everything you're not covering in the other three.
And so let's start with one we don't talk about much, trade secrets. I run into it with clients. And so when you're doing a trade secret, you're not publishing anything publicly. You're keeping that closely held, limited number of people that know about it within your company, right?
That's right. A famous example would be the recipe for Coca-Cola. That's a trade secret that they keep as a secret within their company. I'm sure very few people within the company have their eyes on it. And the way you protect the trade secret is through contracts with your investors, contracts with your employers, contracts with your vendors, and you want to make sure that they're keeping that information in confidence and that they're not dispersing that information to the public.
And so that's not what most people think about when they're protecting their intellectual property. They tend to do the more traditional route we were talking about of trademarks, service marks, copyrights, and patents. And so let's kind of walk through those in any order you want to take them.
Sure. And although they're not protected like copyrights, trademarks, and patents, trade secrets also do bring value to your company and can be considered part of the valuation of your company. So they're a very important piece. We can start with copyrights. That's something a lot of people are familiar with. Copyrights are generally any artistic expression that can be recorded in a media or some physical embodiment. For example, you have a painting or music that you've recorded on a CD, or I guess
on your iPhone
or digitally now. I guess I'm showing my age there. You can also have, say, a dance performance recorded on video or a written book.
Articles, the content on your website.
That's right. Right? That's okay. Right, and on and on. And usually when it comes to the written aspect of copyrights, when you drill down to about a sentence is where you start entering into trademark territory.
Okay.
A trademark, for example, would be a brand or a tagline or maybe a word or a logo.
An acronym.
You can even do stuff that aren't words. I mean, you can do Play-Doh, I believe, just had a smell registered.
Oh, wow. That takes me back to my childhood.
It does. You know, they should have registered the taste, but
yeah. Every child could identify the Play-Doh taste.
That's right.
And when we're thinking about that as business owners, when should we start the conversation to understand, or even as just creative entrepreneurs, say we're an author, we're a musician, we're a singer, we're a songwriter, we're a website developer. When should we start the conversation about strategically what will we copyright? When do we need to look at a trademark or a service mark? Those kind of things.
It's never too early. I think educating yourself about the issues is the first part, because then you know what is protectable and what isn't protectable, and you can better understand when you might want to do that in the life cycle of your products or services. Generally, though, before you publicly disclose this information, or before you buy that website, or try to start manufacturing that product, or start investing resources into what you're creatively producing, then you should probably consult with an IP expert, whether it be an attorney or an academic, and determine what it is you're trying to protect and how you might best protect that. And hopefully you can get some answers to your questions and figure out the most cost-effective route forward, because a lot of times, you know, you want to make money before you spend money. So there's always that balance between risk and reward.
So with copyrights, do we actually have to file something with the copyright office in order to say we have the copyright on it?
You already have a copyright by just merely putting it in the tangible physical form. A copyright exists. When you register a copyright, you're afforded more legal protection, and it allows you to have some easier avenues to enforcing your protection and preventing others from copying your copyrightable material.
So let's talk about that. So what are the consequences of violating somebody's copyright?
Well, there's legal consequences as far as there can be a monetary value established with what kind of copyright infringement you involved yourself in. And then there's also the actions you're going to have to take. You're going to have to remove that copyrighted material. If you do want to use it, you're going to have to acquire a license from the person who has the copyright. So generally, when you have copyrightable material, you can prevent others from using it. And then if they do use it, you can either cause them to take an action to, you know, right the wrong, or you can be awarded monetary reward.
Is it still $150,000 per copy violation?
That is if you have a registered copyright. Okay. And you are successful in a court proceeding, there could be a statutory fine, and that would be the statutory fine. Frankly, and as is the case with most legal issues, it's rare that you actually make it to the end of a court proceeding. Typically, what you're going to do is reach a settlement and an out-of-court agreement.
So things like photocopying a book. Let's say you buy one copy of the book. You're going to do it in a study group. And so you decide to make 20 copies of that book. That's a violation of a copyright. If that's a registered copyright, that's where you start getting into that person that authored that book could take you to court and start court proceedings when they find out you've made 20 copies of their book.
That's right. There could be a violation there, of course, with every rule. And this is why the lawyers always like to get involved.
It depends.
It depends. There's always exceptions. So in this case, you mentioned an academic group or a study group. There's fair use principles that allow you to use it within certain degrees and settings. If you were making copies of that art print you saw in a book and putting it all around town to promote your band playing on Saturday, that's not an educational use. That's a commercial use. What you were talking about was a study group, and that could be considered an educational fair use. So there's really a...
Even when they're, like, let's say they're textbooks.
Even when they're textbooks. If you're making a copy, say, for yourself or for your personal use. Now, if you're making 20 copies of that for everybody within your study group and only one of you purchased the book, well, now you're stretching that fair use because you're avoiding purchasing that book by making the 20 copies. It's not as if you were passing around in class to highlight a particular example as a teacher where everybody already had the textbooks in hand. So there's a lot of context involved with each case.
And so we always have to be aware then that as an author or as, you know, we're doing podcasting or, you know, you write the scripts, you do those kind of things. So are there multiple copyrights then? So if I write a script for something, let's say a TV show, is that script copyrighted and I can register that? And then when I make the TV show, is that a separate copyright or are those joint copyrights?
So technically, yes, okay. You can get different copyrights on those. But if we back up a little bit, if you have, say, performed a song and you have a copyright on a recorded version of that song and somebody takes the lyrics of those songs and posts them on their website, they're still infringing the copyright of your song. So there is still copyright, or they're potentially infringing, depending on the case. Of course, it depends.
It all depends.
There's potential infringement there. That's not to say that you couldn't have received two separate copyrights for the lyrics themselves and for the song. A copyright for the lyrics themselves, for example, would protect you if somebody performed portions of those lyrics in a much different manner. So when a court or when an attorney or when you are deciding whether or not there is a copyright infringement, there's a lot of different factors to consider. And so
we consult our IP attorneys and say, help us figure out, did we do something wrong? Because a lot of times when I'm in with clients and in there, and I'll see them say maybe they have a cartoon strip. And in the cartoon strip, they've put, you know, a website name. And I said, oh, I didn't know you bought that domain name. Well, no, we're just using it in the cartoon strip. Those kind of things are domain names. When someone purchases that domain name, if it's not yours and you use it in a copyrighted work, is there permissions for that? You need to use that? How technical are those kind of things? And are those things we need to be concerned with that you kind of one-off make? We made up that domain name for the comic strip. Turns out it's really somebody's domain name.
There's a lot of issues involved there. One is, you know, if you're just creating a parody and you're using the domain of a company or a issue that you're parodying, you may have fair use exceptions apply there. The second is, does the domain name itself have a trademarked product within it? If you're using www.coca-cola.com and Coca-Cola has the registered trademark for Coca-Cola, okay, maybe there's an issue with the trademark there and not necessarily the domain itself. Then there's a consideration of whether or not you're disparaging the domain name and whether or not you're misleading the public as to the nature of the domain. So when we're
thinking about intellectual property, so this is all very interwoven. So we can copyright the song, we can create an animated cartoon strip, you know, quotes around that, because using some of those apps and things that you can do, and then you've put that domain in. You really need to be thinking legally about the things that you're creatively doing and having a conversation as, am I going to copyright this? Am I creating a character that needs to be trademarked? Am I putting something in it that may be somebody else's trademark? Am I using the Petty Blue for the race car? You know, it's all of those different types of things that as business owners, we need to consciously be thinking of as we make these decisions.
That's right. And if you step back and just talk about IP generally, what you're asking yourself when you're in those situations as a somebody who's a businessman or a business person or a artist of some sort is, are you taking somebody else's creative or inventive expression and using it for your own commercial gain? If that's the case, you could be potentially...
Commercial gain is the key.
Commercial gain is a very important piece. Okay. That's right. It's possible you could be involved in copyright infringement without commercial gain, but it's less likely. And then if you are involved in commercial gain and it is off somebody else's artistic expression or inventive work, yes, there could be exceptions involved, but you don't want to be too lenient with yourself because the risk you're taking on there can be significant, as you mentioned, the statutory fines.
Right.
So at that point, if you do feel like you're getting commercial gain off somebody else's work, you may want to consult with somebody or at least do some research on your own.
So when something is inspired by, so you see somebody's artwork and you do something and you're inspired, are there lines that we have to think of as business owners or creative people that we need to educate ourselves on in advance? And are there places that, like, do we go to the Forest Farm website and see some articles by Lyle that talk about what is a copyright? When is it going to move into trademarks and those kind of things? And how can we have those conversations?
So we do have a lot of blogs on the Forest Farm website. You can go there and go to the blog section and just search intellectual property, patents, copyrights, et cetera. And you can find some articles written there. Generally,
it gives us the framework.
Right. It'll give you the framework. And I think the first step is to educate yourself about what are the issues. And if you feel like you're entering into some gray territory, pick up the phone and call an attorney that can help you, hopefully have a free conversation.
It's complex. We were talking before we went on the air. Everybody knows I'm an author. With authors, many times we see them having pen names. I mean, Mark Twain was Samuel Clemens. I mean, those are some of the famous ones that we know. And that's to keep different brands and things separate. Mm-hmm. But when we start talking about assuming identities, which a pen name or a nom de plume is, then how do the legal aspects contractually work? How does it work for the purpose? And then how's it working on trademarking or branding that? Because that's not our name, right? And that's things that we have to think about as authors. Even as singers, Garth Brooks, I think, used a fake name for some project. And
I didn't realize that at
one point. And it was just when we're sitting there and we're thinking about it from a creative person protecting our intellectual property and our assets to monetize them or even not to monetize them, but just so that we have that credit for it. And then if we do want to monetize them, do we put them in a business? Do we do them as an individual? Those are conversations that strategically we really need someone to help guide us through that, because this is like a fabric with lots of different strands going through it for us to know and protect our assets.
That's right. And, you know, one of the reasons the word intellectual is in intellectual property is because it is a bit ephemeral. It's not an actual thing that you can hand off to somebody else physically. It's usually something that is captured legally. And you were mentioning pen names, and you can think of pen names similar to the creation of an LLC, for example.
Right.
It's an entity that you as an individual or you and your partners have created. It does have an actual existence, and it does have rights and value within it, but it's something that you've created. And the same thing with the pen name. You can create a brand around your pen name. You can create value, and that pen name itself can have certain ownership rights. And
yeah, and it's funny because I was doing research on it before I called you. I said he was my attorney. And I didn't realize that sometimes pen names are owned by 5 or 6 authors, and they either collaborate or they take turns using the pen name. And it's just an interesting thing to see, and thinking of it as an LLC or an S corporation or a, you know, this kind of thing does help you think of it as a separate entity that you have to manage and have deep conversations about.
Yeah, another similar entity would be, say, the Dummies series of books. When you have series of how-to books, oftentimes there's
many
names
for dummies. Yeah,
right. Right. There's plenty of authors involved. There's plenty of editors. There's plenty of various people involved in those, but they've got a consistent brand and a value in that brand.
And that's that dummy series is owned by one of the publishing houses, I think, right?
I believe it is a publishing house that owns it now. I don't know how it
I don't
originated.
Know how it started either, right. But yeah. And so you're looking at that, and you strategically have to think, am I just doing it to have a different brand and be able to have a different author page? Or, as we were talking before, is it truly to keep your identity separate and try to keep it secret, those kind of things? And so it's really thinking about what are you doing with that intellectual property you're creating. Now, most of our listeners probably are probably more familiar with patents, I think. And
thanks to Shark Tank.
Shark Tank and just coming out of the university systems and the right. large corporations and things that are around here. And, well, you know, I mean, we know Tesla, we know Einstein, we know all of these different inventors and stuff. And you'll frequently see how many, you know, how many patents is issued to this person and that kind of thing. And so we think of it there, but even when we're doing patents, there's times that copyrights and trademarks start flowing into that. So if you create an invention and you call it something, well, now do we want to trademark that name?
That's right. Right.
And then, well, maybe we've created directions or something and then on how to use that device. And so now we're copywriting directions. You know, there's just this all interweaving into it. So let's talk about trademarks a little bit and mm-hmm. the difference between a trademark and a service mark. And then we'll have a great big conversation on patents and changes.
Sounds good. So, you know, we were talking about copyrights and I said, when you kind of whittle down a written copyright down to one sentence, you start then looking at trademarks. Sure, you can have trademarks that are longer as
Nike,
well.
Nike, just do it.
Da-na-na, by ESPN. Right. That sound is trademarked. You've got various slogans and logos. The McDonald's arches, for example.
Right. Different colors.
Some people right. have trademark colors, but I don't want the listeners to get right. too excited about that because that requires a lot of technical issues to be aligned for you to get that.
It's an expensive
trademark.
Conversation.
It is. And, you know, the Pink Panther insulation is a famous one. They've right. trademarked the color pink when it comes to insulation.
I think Equal trademarked the blue for their packets.
That's right. And one thing you'll notice with all these color trademarks, or most of them, I would say, is a relatively large famous brands. You're going right. to have to show that
deep pockets
and they've established such a presence in their industry that that color is now universally right. almost associated with them.
So that takes me back to something I meant to ask with the trademarks. Google. We say we Google it, but Google is a trademark. We say Kleenex, but Kleenex is a trademark. So when brands become so large and
they're
registered.
You're going to get a letter from those two companies?
Yeah. but they've become verbs, right? Or they've become associated with the entire segment of the marketplace.
So those companies are going to do what we call policing their mark. Once you have a registered trademark, you'll want to make sure that other people aren't using it inappropriately. And one way to inappropriately use a mark is to use it as if it is a verb or if it is a noun. For example, Nike does not want you to go say, "Hey, I went and bought some Nikes today." They want you to say, "I bought some Nike athletic shoes." Nike is a brand name. Athletic shoe is a product. So that if the name gets used generically, where it's just describing a whole class of products, or as a verb, you're Googling something, if the public starts using in that generic fashion, it could devalue that brand. And so those companies put a lot of money and time and resources into making sure that the public uses them properly. Uses their brands right. properly, and that they themselves use their brands properly.
So even when we're starting out, because I know when I started Focus Resources, that was considered common usage or common names, common words, common combinations. It wasn't the only Focus Resources. Can't get a trademark. But then over time, because of the logo, the acronym of Focus, what it stood for versus we filed it, and then we ended up with the trademark for it. So there, as a small business, that was worth the investment for me to protect Focus Resources and have that brand and what it stood for and all the categories and things. And so when we're thinking of that, when I was making that decision, I wanted something that went beyond the company and everybody just saying, "Oh, Focus Resources, there's 300 of them in North America. That was an investment I chose to make to have intellectual property. So how and when do we have that conversation as a business owner when we're starting and what do we need to bring to the table to someone like yourself to say, this is what I'm thinking and how hard is this going to be and how expensive is it going to be?
So as an attorney, we would prefer for every client out there, for every business out there to be able to register their trademark, form their LLC before they get started, make sure that they have an attorney reviewing all their contracts. I mean, there are a lot of things that you can put together at the beginning to minimize risk. And as an attorney, our job is to help you minimize risk. It's an entrepreneur's job, though, to grow their business. And sometimes they have to take risks and be tolerant of risk in order to bootstrap and grow. So there's always going to be a little tug and pull between what I'm suggesting would you should do in a perfect world and what you can actually do as an entrepreneur and what you should do. So I can give a lot of advice, but then what the business person needs to do is decide, what's my return on the investment going to be? What is that timeline going to be? And how risk tolerant am I? What are the negative consequences if I don't do this? So when it comes to trademarks, I think the very first thing you want to do is run a search. You need to find out, is the trademark available? Can you even use that brand name, or does somebody else have rights to it? Secondly, if you do use that brand name, if it's okay for you to do it, how much coverage and how much protection can you get? And do you want that now, or are you willing to do that later? So running the search is a quick, easy first step. Registering the trademark is a second longer
step. I have to do this. Are we going to Google it, or or are we doing on the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office? Are we looking at domain names and like going on GoDaddy and doing a domain name search? What are we doing in the search? And can we do some of it ourselves, or do we need the expertise of the attorney to help us do that?
So first, you should do it yourself. You may get an answer that says, nope, somebody else has rights in this, and you don't have to contact an attorney at all. That'll save you time. Maybe it'll save you money as well. Where you want to run a search is you run it on Google. And then the second one is on the trademark database. It's called TESS, T-E-S-S, Trademark Electronic Search System.
So just type in USPTO TESS on your Google search, and it'll come up, and you can click through.
That's right. So run it on a search engine, run it on TESS, and what you want to do is find out, is there another registered mark out there that is, quote-unquote, confusingly similar to yours, or are there brands that are using the name that are confusingly similar to you? To yours, and you're seeing air quotes, but the listeners
yes.
aren't. Confusingly similar means is the word itself or the phrase very similar to your phrase, and are the goods and services you're covering similar? In other words, if you're selling shoes, is there somebody else selling shoes as well, or are they selling cars, which
right.
wouldn't be confusingly similar?
Well, I know when I did my second one on Technovation, it's spelled, you know, it's T-E-C-H-N-O-V-A-T-I-O-N. It came back, it sounded like somebody else's.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't, if you looked at it, and then we had to go back to that debate with the Patent and Trademark Office as to, well, no one's going to confuse it because they were, in such dissimilar categories as to what it was. And so those conversations did require additional investment to do
mm-hmm.
that, but it does make it different. And in both cases of the things that I have trademarked, it has stood me in good stead, especially within the state, when someone registered a Focus Resources company in here to compete against me out of Charlotte, and we could send the cease and desist letter because it is in that category. I have the name in North Carolina. I have it protected and those kind of things. And so that would have been more expensive to try to separate our brands and things out and say, no, that's not me. But we were monitoring it and searching and keeping things like that mm-hmm. going. And so, and again, that's something we kind of have to keep an eye on, even as a small business, right? Monitoring
right.
our IP to see who's infringing and when they're infringing and what's the use and those kind of things.
Right. And I want to step back a little bit and caution the listeners. You know, you can run a search yourself and you can figure out whether or not there are barriers to entry. What I would caution, though, is not to get too excited about the results if they're positive.
Right.
Because you may need an expert to run that search for you. It's easy to find the answer no. It's harder to find the answer yes. And even an attorney or a search service is going to qualify their answer and say, look, we think that you're good here, but there's always a risk out there that maybe somebody doesn't have internet presence and they have a mom-and-pop
right.
store in California, and they will be allowed to use their
mark. And what I find is I run into more – I think I was on LinkedIn. I actually had someone call me on LinkedIn tell me I had to stop using Focus Resources because that was hers, and she'd just gotten on LinkedIn. And every time somebody typed in Focus Resources, I was coming up. Well, I've been on LinkedIn since LinkedIn's around, and Focus Resources has been around 16 years now. And so it was just kind of an interesting – thing that this person didn't understand, that there were a lot of focus resources on there. But because of the number of searches and the length of time and content and things, social media is going to drive to the top the one that has the most content mm-hmm. and the most visibility and connections. And she can use focus resources. We're not in any similar fields or anything. But she can't stop me from using it, and I already had the trademark on it.
Right. So, you know, as to the value of the trademark, you have trademark rights when you're using your brand commercially. You already mm-hmm. have limited trademark rights, and they're limited to the exact goods and services you're using and the geographic area in which you're using them. It gets a little complicated with the internet now because everybody wants to claim their geographic area is everywhere, but it's
Truthfully, it's where you filed, right? Within the U.S. borders, it's a U.S. trademark. Well, it's not valid in
Europe. If you have a registered trademark. Right. But if you're just using the brand, you have limited rights where you are. You then register your trademark because then your coverage and your rights then automatically expand nationally. Regardless of whether you're operating in Arizona, you now have Arizona trademark rights. The second value comes in enforcement and deterring. Now you can deter others from using your brand, and you can enforce your rights against them. And it's a lot easier to send somebody a letter when you say, I have a registered trademark, as opposed to saying, I was here before you.
Right.
It gets into a bit of a tit for tat at that point.
And so it's being conscious. If you're going to invest in it, you also have to invest some time and effort in maintaining and protecting them once they've been issued.
That's right. It's always advisable to, you know, pick up the computer every once in a while, every month or so, and run a quick search and see what else is out there. See if other brands are popping up, because you want to nip that in the bud as soon as possible. If somebody has just started out their business, they're much more agile and likely to change directions and rebrand than if you let them operate for a year and then try to tell them to change.
Right.
So it behooves both of you to do the searches early and often.
So the difference between a trademark and a service mark, what is the difference?
So sometimes a trademark covers goods, a service mark covers services, but technically they're both trademarks. Some people call them service marks and put the SM instead of the TM. Frankly, my practice is to use a TM on everything and call everything a trademark. I don't really do much distinguishing, because a lot of my clients will have a brand name that covers both goods and services.
Right.
And so I'm not in the habit of distinguishing between the two.
So whether we filed it or not, can we put the TM on it, or is it only for filed?
You can put the TM beside it when you do have a brand that you're using in association with commercial goods and services. That's correct. The circle R stands for registered trademark, and that you can only use when you have your registered trademark.
Right. So like, right. I could put the circle R beside my Focus Resources logo because that's what's trademarked.
When you're using Focus Resources in association with the goods and services that are covered by your mark.
Right.
If for some reason you decide to sell a car tomorrow using Focus Resources, if you had a dedicated loan page for that,
right.
you shouldn't use your circle R beside that. It should be a TM.
Unless it was one of the categories that I was crazy enough to get for it.
That's right. That's right.
So, again, it could be artwork can be trademarked. So the swoosh for Nike.
Mm-hmm.
The tagline can be trademarked separately. The combination, that's what we have to be thinking about when we're doing it.
That's right. You could have several different trademarks involved in your branding. If you have a logo and then under it, it has your brand name, and then under that, it has a tagline. All three of those can be trademarked in various combinations or separately. Typically, what you would preferably be able to do is trademark them each separately, so that when they stand alone out there and aren't used together, they're individually protected. Sometimes that's not available, and so you want to make some combination efforts to get creative with your trademark.
So now the rest of the hour is going to be patents.
Okay.
So what is the new rules? I think it used to be first to invent, and now it's first to file for patents. Explain the difference and why we matter, and what type of patents are they in that goes in it?
So most of the rest of the world has been first to file, and the U.S. has kind of been a big exception, a big carve-out, and we were first to invent up until 2013 when the American Invent Act was passed. The big difference there is before 2013, when it was first to invent, if you were kind of late to the patent office, you could contest somebody else's filing by saying, hey, I was here first, and you could file and submit proof and be
predate their filing
and be able to acquire your own rights separately, even though you're second.
Jumping ahead, you're jumping behind.
Right.
You're jumping back in time rather than ahead in time, because you had your research book, you had your field notes, you had whatever it was that you were working on to say, I was here first.
That's right.
Now it's who's first in the office with the fee.
That's right. Who's first in the office with the fee? So you wanna get to the patent office quickly. You still have the opportunity to contest somebody else's filing if, for example, they stole the work from you, or you did predate them and publicly disclose your invention before they filed. So you can prove to the patent office, look, this was already out there. It was out there before they filed their patent application. They shouldn't get a patent, but
you don't get one either.
You don't get one.
Okay.
So that's what the main difference is there.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so what is that process? What do we have to bring in to our patent attorney or agent, or what do we need if we have a tangible invention we've created?
The legal term is fully conceived idea, and that needs a little explanation as well.
Go for it.
Generally, if you can describe your invention to someone else to a degree that they could reproduce it if they were an expert in the field, you have a fully conceived idea. Now, if we were inventing a table, for example, we don't have to choose the color or what kind of laminate we're going to put on top, unless that's a unique aspect of it. But we do have to know, how is it going to stand? How are the legs going to attach to the table so they can actually support weight? But there can be minor details that are left out that don't need to be decided on. So fully conceived idea means you need to be able to have a working prototype, but it doesn't need to be in its fully finished
form. Can we say it's mainly the form and function, but the cosmetics don't have to be figured out?
To a degree, right? Okay. The aesthetics don't need to be figured out, but the same with the various screw size or thread count on the screws. You know, there's some functionality that can still be left in the gray area. But the meat and potatoes of what you've invented, you need to have that worked out. And you need to be able to know that with minor experimentation, you're going to be able to build a working prototype, assuming you had the resources.
And so what is that type of patent called? Is it?
You're looking at a utility patent at that point. There's some other patents. We have a plant patent, which very few of the listeners will probably be interested in. It's creating a new type of plant species. And then you have a design patent. The design patent is pretty much the opposite of a utility patent. You're covering the aesthetic features, the beauty features, and you're not covering any of the functional items.
And so would it be unusual for someone to have both a design and a utility patent?
That is not unusual. It can be common. For example, a shoe. We'll keep using Nike as an example. They can have a very unique stitch pattern on the outside of their shoe that could be covered by a design, but then they could have that famous pump on the back that could be covered by a utility.
Okay, and so, again, when we're thinking about what we're creating, let's say I'm at home and I'm tinkering in my garage and I come up with something, but it's related to what I do in my day job because it's the field I'm in. And let's say I'm a mechanical engineer for Goliath, Inc., Am I able to file a patent for what I tinkered around and came up with on my job? Or do I have to look back to my employer, Goliath, Inc., and see if there's any claims or any overlap that they would have to my intellectual property before I filed the patent?
I'll just say it depends. you want to be careful in those situations. If you are inventing in a field that is similar to your day job, you want to be very careful to make sure that you're not inventing at work. You're not using work resources.
Not their computer, not their email, not their phone.
Not talking it with all your colleagues and getting a bunch of advice on the job. And
not
using
the copying machine.
Right.
Not that, yeah.
Yeah. As much as is possible, you want to isolate those two aspects of your life. because it is easy for a work to claim that they have rights. Not easy, but it is reasonable for a work to claim that they have, an employer to claim that they have rights in your inventive work if it is very similar to your day job, particularly if you've been using their resources and doing it on their dime. So you do want to keep those separate. And if you feel like you're working on something at home that could overlap with what you're doing at your employer's job, then you probably need to talk to an attorney and make sure that you're putting the processes in place to keep those separate and to maintain the rights to your invention separately.
And so when we're thinking about, let's just stick with utility patents. Do I have to file the utility patent application right away, or is there a step I can take until I'm figuring out that it can hold my place in the line now that it's first to file?
Right. So there's two aspects to this. One is you can publicly disclose your patent, and the U.S., unlike a lot of countries, gives you a grace period where you have 1 year to then file for protection. You want to be careful, though, because as soon as you publicly disclose, you're now at risk of somebody else filing and beating you to the patent office.
And having deeper pockets.
And, well, and
because
you
can't defend,
you lose your
it,
right because
it,
it's first
okay,
to file.
Right.
You know, you may be able to push back at them, but regardless, you've lost your right at that point. But I think what you were alluding to is a provisional patent application,
yeah,
as opposed to the non-provisional. The provisional patent application is, as you said, it's just a way for you to stick your flag in the ground and say, I was here on this date. Let me get back to you.
Okay.
And the provisional patent application lasts for 1 year only. It never gets examined formally. They make sure that you have some appropriate documentation in order, but an examiner is never going to pick it up and determine whether or not it's actually patentable. And during that year, it gives you time to talk to the public about it, seek investment, do some experimentation, build a prototype, look for financing, all the other business aspects, and do it open and freely.
So, but I would need to be concerned that once I started that, if I get to day 365 and I haven't filed the actual patent filing, then what happens?
There are some concerns because at that point, if you've disclosed it publicly, you only have 1 year from your public disclosure date to file a patent application. So if the 1 year date hits, those rights are expiring and you have to start the process over. You want to convert either into a formal application at that time, or if you've kept it as a secret at that 1 year date, you can let the provisional expire, file some paperwork, and then refile your provisional and start the process over.
But you've lost that date from a year ago.
You've lost that date for a year ago, and you've possibly carried the risk now that you've been talking to people about it. You've possibly carried the risk of having a public disclosure during that time as well that we have to worry about.
Now, you said that's true here in the States. We have a year. But what if we're wanting to patent it in Europe or Asia and different countries too? If we disclose it publicly here, does that put us at risk for being able to get patent registration and international patent coverage?
It does in some areas, and most particularly Europe. They do not allow any grace period. Japan, for example, allows a 6-month grace period. So it really depends. To play it safe, if you think you're going international, you definitely want to have a provisional application at minimal filed before you publicly disclose. So we talked about trade secrets earlier. One way to protect yourself in the interim is to protect your patentable invention and the know-how and the methods around it using trade secret protection through contracts. Have your friends or investors or
anyone you're going to share it with.
Anyone you're going to share it with. Sign non-disclosure and confidentiality agreements. Make sure that they're not going to place it on a website or post about it in social media.
And so, again, we need to strategically sit down as researchers, as in garage inventors, as tinkerers, as creative people, and decide, is this intellectual property we want to protect, or is it just going to be out in the shared universe where everybody can do it? Which kind of brings me to a question of things that are open sourced.
Mm-hmm.
So let's, and you feel free to say it depends, but what I see a lot of people participating in invention groups, whether that's for an app, or they get together and they're gonna come together and there are no legal agreements. They're just sharing their idea in a room full of for a contest, or they're gonna get people chipping in and help with us. And then I see what I call trolls running around making notes or attending these events to hear these ideas for these apps or even, you know, tangible goods and things of that nature. And once you've made a disclosure like that and there are no legal agreements about who's participating or someone comes in and they start designing it for you, you have an incomplete concept. You sort of know what it wants to do and they're sitting there helping it get designed. They're doing drawings. They're helping you map out an app. When do they become part of the invention and have to go on the patent or have to go as part owner on a copyright? Or if they're helping create the trademark and they're not getting paid, how do all of those things come in? Because I see it more and more where people are having people that are not in a legal agreement with them. They're at a startup event. They stand in front of a room of 500 people that they don't know. And they share what the concept is and they spend a weekend. And they're really sharing their idea and their intellectual property. And only one or two of those ideas will get funded by whoever's there to invest. And everything else is just out there.
That's right. I mean, that is a public disclosure.
And that's a big public disclosure.
That's a big public disclosure. And so either you want to have protections in place, whether it be a contract with that event, but it doesn't sound like in a lot of those cases it is a private scenario, or you want to have a provisional application filed, or when you're disclosing that information, you want to talk about the problems and solutions from a high level and not get into the inventive technical aspects that you've been working on that you consider your competitive advantage.
Well, and I was at an event over in Durham, and I admit I was freaking out because so many people were talking about apps they were going to develop. And this gentleman was walking around listening to each of the work groups, and he was making notes. And I finally walked up to him and I said, "What are you doing?" He said, "It's not prohibited." I said, "But what are you doing?" He says, "I'm getting all their ideas, and I have a team, and they're going to start programming." And I was like freaking out. And that was when I realized there were no legal agreements. There were nothing with the organizers of that event.
Yeah. And, you know, with a lot of those ideas, though, that they're sharing, when you identify a problem and the fact that there's a need for a solution isn't a patentable idea, where the patentable idea is the solution itself.
Right.
So.
And these people were, I mean, this guy was just literally walking around listening to the discussion and looking at the drawings of how things were going to flow and how they were going to work and what the problem was. And I was just sitting there thinking, wow, he just got like 20 apps.
Right. So, you know, he's identifying opportunities that these other people are disclosing to him. And when you're telling the world about opportunities, you need to expect some competition. So you need to be careful about when you start disclosing that and screaming from the top of the mountain. You know, how far along in the process are you? If you're not going to be developing a solution to it, sure, throw it out there.
90% of these companies or people that were in there had a company they had formed and were there to help get it started. They hadn't written a code. They didn't know how to write code. And they were just there to get apps developed and have free resources to help them. And I'm thinking, well, those are free resources until, you know, that game becomes a multi-billion dollar game. And then the lawsuit comes because there's no agreement between it. And then there's the troll walking around.
It's just risk versus reward at that point. You know, as attorneys, we're going to be very cautious and be concerned about that. But as some inventors, I say, well, this is how I get to, you know, step B. So I'm going to take this risk now and hope that I get there. And it's really just it's a business decision. It's what do you need and what's most important.
Of the companies I tracked that came out of there, none of them actually ended up with an app that went to market. Something beat them to the market. I don't know if it was that guy or, you know, somebody else, but nobody made it out of that. And that is concerning to me that it went public, these ideas, and then, you know, they didn't have the next step position. They kind of thought everything was going to happen at that event.
Yeah, one of the hardest steps I see for inventors is taking the leap from ideation to commercialization, whether it's developing a working prototype or if they don't have the finances for developing the working prototype, acquiring investment and partners that can get them to that step. That's where the attrition happens.
Well, and sometimes you create a great prototype or a great product and you get the working prototype, but the cost to tool, even for a major manufacturer, prohibits them doing a deal with it. And so let's kind of talk about those kind of things too. For I get my patent. It's a great idea. I don't want the business. I don't want to be in manufacturing, but I want to license that. How do I figure out what it's worth? How do I go out and find potential companies to license it? And what things do I need to think about?
There is no easy answer for those steps, but it takes a lot of work and the ability to hear no a lot and keep persevering. But generally, it just takes time and effort. I mean, you're going to have to sit down, identify where your market is, identify who you think great partners are. And I would suggest don't go with the best partner first. What you want to do is hone in your salesmanship and your skills a little bit in developing those relationships. So start with somebody that maybe is less attractive to your business and work on your pitch with them. Learn what they value as important and take that back and reformulate and then do the pitch over and over. And once you think you've honed in your craft a little bit there, then go to the most attractive partner for your company or business and start making that pitch.
Well, and it's interesting because we've been working on some of it for quite a while and having those conversations. And then the other thing I have found in talking with potential partners to license it is understanding that if they get too excited about it and they want to start too big, it doesn't start because they want, 20 versions of it and all these fancy different things. And I was like, let's just get the first one out in the most simple form, get it out into the market, get the buzz, pick a segment of the market.
Absolutely.
And get it going. But when they're talking about, $5 million in tooling and it's going to take this much inventory. And I'm like, can we shoot for selling 10,000?
Two big issues there. Don't let perfect be the enemy of good.
Right.
You need to put something out there. And second, don't overcomplicate things and try to do 10 things at once. Focus on your bread and butter, your highest potential market. Go there first. You've always got opportunity to grow in the future.
Right. And working on that is finding the more information you have and the more research you have into what the price points are and why that fit is there. Making that investment's important, but also keeping it current with that investment. Because I think in one of the deals we were trying to negotiate, the price point hadn't been updated to take into effect. And so when you say something's, you sell it for $129. Well, that was 5 years ago. $129 today may not be enough in the marketplace for that, or it might be too high, depending on what the competition is out there. And staying current on all that information and then understanding how it would fit in somebody else's product line with what they're already doing. And could they take some version of what they're doing and incorporate whatever your technology and your tools are?
Yeah, you mentioned some of these groups earlier. I think one of their greatest functions is getting people from the point of having their idea and their business that has been created, but they just can't move to the commercialization stage or grow their business to a certain point. It's teaching them how to make those pitches, identify the issues that they need to focus in on, identify what their bottom line is and how to structure that so that they're spending efficiently and effectively.
I mean, actually, at some of these events, the best pitches have been made by the 10-year-olds. Because they have no fear. They're getting up there and they're just so confident in their ideas and things, and their parents are there. But they're the ones up there and they're pitching. And I mean, some of these guys, these kids have been the ultimate salespeople. And then others have had such a cute approach to why they had the idea and explaining that. But again, it adds another layer when the inventor's under 18, right? And then you're talking to them and trying to get everyone to realize, now you're dealing with a minor. Let's say it's a website. Well, if it's a website for somebody under 13, we got all those lovely European rules and data information and all that kind of stuff. And so we really have a lot more things that we have to think about with intellectual property, with data rights, with ownership, with who's the inventor and the co-inventors on a patent, who drew the artwork, who built the website, who wrote the content.
That's right.
And getting real clarity on that. For us as a business.
You touched on a couple of points that are important to a lot of those app and software developers out there. One thing you need to do from the beginning is identify where you're getting all your freeware, shareware. You want to have an Excel sheet that's tracking where a lot of that code's coming from, because although it's free code, some of it does still have implications for you down the road when it comes to licenses and use. The second thing, as you touched on, was the data and privacy issues. if you're collecting data from people, whether it be minors or adults, you need to have a policy in place that the users can read and understand their rights and what you're doing with the data. And you need to abide by European privacy laws.
GDPR.
Because it doesn't matter that you're just here in the U.S. and you're dealing with people locally. They're Europeans locally. And that law still applies to them locally here.
Yeah. And so it's really taking time. I like going to nolo.com. That's why I tell a lot of my clients just to go get a book in normal English that explains what's a copyright, what's a trademark, what's a patent, and what you need to be thinking about it, and educate yourself, and then have some advisors come in and work with you from the business standpoint and from the legal perspective to decide, I'm going to protect this. This is the top priority. I'm not going to protect that. Or this is the logo, the tagline are going to be together, or they're going to be separate, and all of those types of aspects.
Yeah, if you can't find it online, you can't find it on the blogs we have at forestfirm.com. You can always reach out to me, and I'll have a conversation.
That's Forest with two R's.
Forest with two R's, that's correct. Thank you.
Forestfirm.com, I always have to check that for myself. I want to thank Lyle for being on the show. Again, he is with the Forest Firm, and again, it's forestfirm.com, and you can reach out to Lyle at lyle.gravatt, G-R-A-V-A-T-T, at forestfirm, two R's in forest.com. Thanks for being on the show, Lyle.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Everyone, until next time, stay focused on the important things.